Every time we feature a segment on dying, we mention the fact that people do not like to talk about dying much. All the more reason to address it before it is imminent, to consider what might happen and how we can best function as caregivers and survivors. A pair of Rogue Valley authors with experience dealing with the dying published a book for people caring with a person whose days are running out. Yana Beecham and Katie Ortlip are the authors of Living with Dying, a complete guide for caregivers. And they're here in the studio with me. Pleasure to have you both here. Yana and Katie.
Great Thanks. To be here, Jeff.
So this is not just an interest for you. You got some experience here. Would you tell us of your work, starting with Katie?
Well, I've been working at Asante Hospice for 25 years, and I started as a nurse, and now I'm doing social work. So, you know, I started there 25 years and have stayed the course. It's a wonderful team to work with. And as you can imagine, we've all grown over the 25 years, and our hospice has grown.
What got you into this in the first place? I always wonder what motivates somebody to work in hospice.
Well,
care.
I've always been fascinated by birth and death. And earlier in my life, I lost a couple of sisters. And it just put me to this soul searching, wanting to know everything I could about death, reading everything I could. And I realized there's a lot I couldn't understand about death. And so when this position opened at Asante, I had just moved out here, and again, I started as a nurse. It just seemed the right fit for me. I felt very comfortable talking about dying. I had been through grief myself. I had been with a sister who died, and the other one died in a sudden accident. So I just had this experience with it, and I felt very comfortable being with people in this at this time. And so it was really more of a calling.
So Yana Beecham, tell us a bit about your story.
Oh, well.
And how you guys came to join forces, too.
Oh, okay. Well, so I've been an author for 30 years. My husband and I write together under the pen name Yana and Malcolm, so we've written lots of books for young adult and juveniles. But we became friends and then became neighbors. And once I was Katie's neighbor, she would come home from work often and say, "Today was a good death." So of course, naturally, I want to know what a good death is because that's what we all want. So I'd pump her for all the details. And she started just filling me in on what her day's activities were. And then when my father got ill, he went on hospice. And we'd already been talking about maybe doing a book because Katie had said that she has to say the same information to her patients and their families over and over and over again. And maybe they needed a manual, kind of a bullet-pointed, bolded, you know, easy to read, not a dense book, but something that's really just the facts, ma'am, with a little warmth and humor in it, hopefully.
Just the facts, ma'am, but, you know, a little more than the facts.
But, yeah.
Everything in one
but
book.
The facts and the stories.
It is sure. It is very complete. I should point that out. I mean, you're really getting right down to the nitty-gritty of very physical details about what goes on when you're dealing with a person and the things that happen to them in the final stages of life, not all of which we'll get to in the 20 minutes or so we have. But I want to ask Katie, first of all, the vast majority of deaths still in hospitals?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think people would be surprised to hear that about 80 to 90% of people wish to die at home when they're asked, and about 20% of people die at home. I was trying to find this statistic for Oregon. I thought it might be higher, more deaths at home, but I couldn't find it. But it might be a little bit more here because we're kind of ahead of the game with dying in this state. But yeah, we need to do a better job. And part of this book is helping people have the confidence and decrease their fear and anxiety so they can do this, because people do want to care for their loved ones at home, but they're afraid. Sometimes treatment goes on too long, and I think we could do a much better job.
It seems like there's a point of separation where no more can be done, and people, family members, and especially when you're dealing with somebody you love, are afraid to make the call and say, okay, I recognize the fact that there's nothing the hospital can do, so let's go home. I mean, is that really one of the issues here?
Yeah, we get a lot of people right out of the hospital. They've just gotten the news that, you know, the cancer is spread, no more treatment options. They've just had a crisis. So sometimes we get people toward the end. And I think some of these late referrals could be prevented if there was more discussion earlier on. Sometimes the physicians don't want them to give up hope. But you don't have to give up hope to go on hospice. I mean, you can still, you know, your hopes may change to a better quality of life and spending this time in a way you want rather than going into the hospital for treatment, going into the doctors for treatment. And that's what I try to focus on when I meet with new patients.
I want to point out again, it is a very detailed book. At that, mm-hmm. it's somewhat surprising, Yana Beecham, that it's not a whole lot thicker than this. I mean, how did you guys manage to be so efficient?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, you know, the part back to the bolded, you know, bullet-pointed boxed, we really wanted it to be something that would be a strict field guide. So something that you could actually carry in a bag. And so we kept reducing it. We worked on it for about 5 years. So we started with a lot of information and just kept putting it to digestible amounts so that if you're a caregiver, you can flip to page 35 and something's going wrong. The symptom, we have a whole chapter on symptoms, how to handle things that are going wrong. And you can just flip to that page and it's got real specific information that you can do. And also it gives information what doctors are doing. And it's kind of nice to know what kind of medications people are using. So, because we're all Googling everything. As soon as somebody gets anything, we Google it and try to figure out how we can help. And this book is your answer to Google.
Yeah, like Yana said, we cut a lot. We had to, you know, we said, no, let's cut this down. Let's not include this. We wanted essential information. Because there's plenty of information out there if you want more. But we wanted to, you know, include emotional, spiritual journey, medication, symptoms, what dying is like, grief. We want to have include all that in one manual.
We're talking to Katie Ortlip and Yana Beecham about their book together, Living with Dying, A Complete Guide for Caregivers. They'll be appearing tonight at 7 o'clock at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland, but they're here in the exchange right now. If you have questions or comments, we'd like to hear from you by phone at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org, and we have a call from Steve in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with the authors.
Howdy.
Hi.
Hi.
In your book, do you at all touch on Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, or are you talking completely natural deaths?
We do have some information on that, and we also have websites that you can go to get more information. But yes, that is something we do touch on in the book.
Is that some information you've been seeking, Steve, and have a hard time getting a hold of?
Not really. I'm familiar with it, but I've had a couple friends that have died in hospice, one of them with dementia, and it was just not a pretty thing. And while he was coherent before, you know, the end of it, he was kind of disappointed that, you know, if he offed himself, you know, he'd lose his insurance that he'd been paying on for years and years. And, you know, he saw no other way out except at the end to be just grueling and in diapers.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned
even death with dignity would have not have helped there, because you got to be coherent in the last 6 months of your, you know, life.
Right. Okay, Steve, thanks for the observations. And then again, yeah, he's mentioned the drooling and diapers story those terms several times.
Death is not pretty. It's hard. And, you know, our goal is to help make it a little bit easier. I mean, it doesn't have to be that hard. But, yeah, dementia is it's one of the more difficult diagnoses.
One of the first things you get to in the book is the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross stages of grief. Mm-hmm. And there's a really interesting thing in here about how you deal with members of the family being at different stages
yes.
in that process.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the recommendations there?
Simply being present. I mean, that sounds so simple, but you know, it's not our job to go in and try to change what someone's feeling or move them to another, quote, stage. Some people are very angry, and you sit and you listen, and you don't tell them not to be angry. People need to feel what they're feeling. And so I tell people, whatever you're feeling is okay, and just encourage them to share it if they want. And sometimes I have to talk to family members individually. Sometimes we all talk together. But I try to get people to give each other room for their feelings. And sometimes just talking about that can just help diffuse the, you know, the emotions in the room. But everyone goes through their own process in a different way.
Plus, you've got a couple of different kinds of relationship dynamics going on here. It's survivor to survivor, but also survivor to dying.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder in particular what the recommendations are for being the responsible party in charge of the caregiving, but also acknowledging that the person who is still lucid and yet dying has some rights, too.
Mm-hmm. And we go into that into the book, too, how to talk with someone who's dying, how to include them. People do not want to be treated like a patient. They still need to be in as much control as possible. So it is important to still include them and include them in decisions. And there might be people that want to check out. They withdraw. They don't want to make decisions anymore. And so, again, it's very individual. Everyone dies in their own way.
When my dad was told that prostate cancer had metastasized to his bones and he was put on hospice, the best way that we had to talk about it was we got an advance directive, and the Oregon has an advance directive that has lots of information, and it's a way to discuss. It's kind of a guided discussion. And the best part about it is we sat in a circle, my husband and myself and my mom and my dad, and we were able to talk about death, like all of our feelings about it, as if it wasn't his death. I mean, we were all just, if this happens, what would you want? Well, here's what I'd want. And we kind of had little checklists, and we had our little booklet that we all filled out, and it gave everybody a little bit of distance to talk about it and not feel like we're grilling my father. But we all got to make a decision about it, and he felt really great about it.
And it sounds like you did it early enough that it still mm-hmm. was sort of an abstraction and mm-hmm. not a concrete thing.
But he was starting to get a little demented. But
he was coherent enough to talk about it. And he wasn't real close to death. There was some time there.
But that's the point. And people need to be willing to get over that reluctance, it sounds mm-hmm. like, to be able to say, hey, look, you know, we need to deal with this now while I'm in pretty good shape. Let's talk mm-hmm. about what I would like to happen before it gets to a point where mm-hmm. I really can't express that.
Yeah, because my husband's brother died last summer or 2 summers ago. He really wanted to talk about it, but his wife didn't. And they really could have, you know, we kept trying to help, but from a distance. But they could have used some sort of guided, like just looking at that booklet, mm-hmm. being able to talk about it.
We are talking to Jana Beecham and Katie Ortlip about their book, Living with Dying, A Complete Guide for Caregivers. It's a very thorough look at the things that someone will have to deal with when they're caring for another person in the final stages of life. They'll be appearing tonight at 7 at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland. They're here now on The Exchange and open to phone calls and emails from you at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Daniel in Grants Pass. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, Jeffrey. Just this a recent revelation for myself. I'm at an age where dying is not that far away, even though I'm healthy. But what I've recognized is that I don't want to accumulate such large medical costs that my family will be destroyed trying to recover after I die. And I recognize also that I have some decisions to make that could affect that cost. Mm-hmm. So that's a question brand new for me, something that I'm looking at, and just love to throw that into the mix here of topics that you guys are covering.
Okay, a great conversation starter. Thanks for that, Daniel. Appreciate it.
Well, as we've been saying, I think starting with the advance directive and documenting what your wishes mm-hmm. are, because most of the cost of dying is at the very end of life when people spend, you know, a week or two in the ICU, and that can run up to, you know, quite a lot of money. So I think if you clarify what your wishes are and talk to your loved ones, talk to the person who's going to be making decisions for you, you know, healthcare representative is included in the advance directive, and you appoint someone that you trust who can carry out your wishes. That's where the bulk of money is spent. It's at the very last few weeks of life. And when we have someone on hospice, they rarely, rarely go back to the hospital. We just had someone who died. He was on hospice for 6 months. Mm-hmm. He had some pretty difficult symptoms. He normally would have probably gone into the ER with them, but instead he called us. And he had a really great last 6 months of his life, and he died at home. And we save the government a lot of money.
Do you?
Yes.
We have Boyd in Wolf Creek by email asking about Pulsed, which you mentioned in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So the Pulsed form for Oregon is what?
The Pulsed is different than the advance directive because it's a physician's order. Mm-hmm. And what you're addressing is more emergency care. So the very first box you check is what if you want to be resuscitated or not, whether you want to be a DNR. Mm-hmm. That's not included on the pulsed. The pulsed is a form that you know pull out of a file when you need it. Mm-hmm. The pulsed you put on your refrigerator. It's bright pink. So if the paramedics are called into your home, they look at that pink form and they know we're not to resuscitate this person.
I've always been fascinated by this ever since I first heard about it. The idea that a paramedic's going to come into your home, look at your refrigerator,
yes.
and if they see the pink form there, hey, let's go.
Well, if there's family there, of course, the family would say, here's the pulse, da-da. Mm. But if there are people that live alone, that's why they really need to have it on their refrigerator. I mean, the paramedics will deal with comfort issues. If someone broke a hip, they're not going to just leave them.
Sure.
They'll take them to the hospital, but they know if someone died, they're not going to try to bring them back. Or if they're close to dying, maybe they'll give them oxygen. Mm-hmm. If they're on hospice, you know, we tell our patients not to call hospice, but occasionally they do.
No, you mean not to call emergency?
Yeah, not to call 911.
Yeah.
on the pulse is our hospice number. So the paramedics know, oh, they're on hospice. I mean, they really should call us first. But, you know, sometimes they panic and call 911.
Okay. Another call here from John in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Katie Ortlip and Yana Beecham.
Yes. What about children? What when a child asks, am I going to die when they have a terminal disease, especially at the time when they're into hospital or in and out? A 10-year-old child asks, am I going to die when they must sense something, but in my case, it was an experience when there was no support or talk about these things.
All right.
Do we cover children?
We very rarely have children, and the children are the hardest patients for me, of course. We have them once in a while, but they tend to go up to Portland or, you know, we treat kids as long as we possibly can. Sometimes they end up in the hospital dying because that's where their support system has been. But we do have children occasionally. Of course, the parents have to be comfortable with how they communicate with their child. You know, I would recommend honesty. I think we need to be honest with kids. A 10-year-old can certainly understand. And I think we're always surprised at how wise children are, especially kids that have been sick for a while. They're pretty wise. And there are some occasions where I had to sit with a child and tell her or him that their parent was dying because they couldn't do it. The family said they couldn't do it. So I sat with maybe some family members, and I was able to tell a child that their mother or father was going to die. And I'm always surprised at how well they cope when we're honest with them and support them.
I had a question about children, too, because there is a reference here to children in the home while the dying process is going on. If it's a parent dying of people who are still not quite adults and how open and honest the conversation should be there, how much to include children in the care of the dying person.
Well, it depends on the age of the child. If children ask questions and want information, I think you should give it to them, but give it to them at their level. You don't want to overload them. And usually when they get enough information, they'll change the subject or go out and play. Mm-hmm. But I think it's good to give them basic information. Use the word die, not daddy's going on a trip or daddy's going to heaven or daddy's going to sleep. I think we need to use the word death and dying. And just always be there for them, always support them. Include them in rituals. Include them towards the end of life with maybe massaging some oil on their feet or bringing in flowers or reading or singing to them. I think that really goes a long way in helping them with their grief.
A couple of questions here about grief, and there's the topic of anticipatory grief is brought up in the book, and I wonder, so this is thinking in advance? I mean, I'm feeling terrible now for what I know is going to happen later?
Yeah, I mean, when we know ahead of time that someone's going to die, we start grieving. We probably start grieving, you know, very early on when someone has a terminal diagnosis. So you start having some of those feelings of grief, whether it's anger, depression, you know, denial. And I think that's what makes caring for someone so challenging is you are actually providing the physical care and grieving. And it's probably the hardest thing people have to do. So it's acknowledging your grief, getting outside help, getting the support you need at the same time you're caring for someone.
When you talk about a good death, I know a lot of people can relate up to a point, but I also wonder how hard they should push it to do things like to make sure that nothing gets left unsaid at the end of life and stuff like that. If you feel like, well, there are some things that I need to say to Dad or Dad needs to say to me, or I mean, how far should people pursue those things in the final days?
Again, it's really very, very personal. We'll be talking about that tonight, a little bit about what makes a good death. Again, I think that it's very rare that we have everything wrapped up when we die. There's always things that are left undone, and I think that's part of dying, is accepting that, letting go and saying, it's okay. But I think it's important to wrap up as much as you can, especially the emotional part with your relationships. If there are things that have been bad and, you know, amends to be made, I think it's, if you can do that, that's great. It helps the grievers. It helps people.
The you've been a big fan of Ira Byock, and you his four things. You want to say, talk about that?
Yeah, Ira Byock has been a big influence in the death and dying field. And he said the important things to say are, forgive me, I forgive you, thank you, and I love you. Say those four things in whatever way you can.
Right. In whatever order.
Put it on a cake, you know, whatever way you can.
Whatever it takes to get it done. Yeah. The book is called Living with Dying, A Complete Guide for Caregivers. We've sort of focused on the abstract and emotional parts of things, but it is a very specific book on right down to things like bedpans. It just gets a lot of stuff done and not very much space. As Jana Beecham mentioned, it's the kind of thing you can put in a bag. They will be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland tonight at 7. Jana Beecham and Katie Ortlip, the authors and our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Pleasure to have you.